Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening. This is the PPSAI Working Group call on the 1st of December, 2015. On the call today, we have Graham Bunton, Holly Raich, Steve Metellus, Theo Geert, Frank Michalik, Lindsay Hamilton-Reed, Brian Symbolic, Paul McGrady, Don Blumenthal, Sarah Bakke, Chris Pelling, Todd Williams, Sean Phelan, Osvaldo Nueva, Roger Carney, James Bodell, Alex Deacon, Darcy Southwell, and Bruce McDonald. We have apologies from Sarah Wild. From staff, we have Mary Wong, Amy Bivens, Malika Koning, Mike Zupke, and myself, Terry Agnew. I would like to remind all participants to please state your name before speaking for transcription purposes. And it looks like Vicki Sheckler just joined us as well. I'll now turn it back over to you, Graham.
Thank you very much. Welcome, everybody, to what may well be the last substantive PPSAI Working Group call. Before we get going, does anyone have updates to their SOI? No? Excellent. Good. Okay. So we have quite a few things to get through today. You can see that long list down the side that goes up to G. I think I've got a couple more on my list that goes up to I. I'm hoping that most of this does not take too much time, and we have 90 minutes today. And so we'll see if we can get through all of this, including going through the executive summary. So why don't we jump right into it then and talk about item A on that list, which is jurisdiction. which was raised by Chris Pelling on email the other day. And I believe if I'm capturing this correctly, it was adding language into the annex around jurisdiction, and so that it was not just the language didn't specify whether or added requester as well as rights holder in case the requester of information is not the direct rights holder, but a proxy for it. Would it be possible to find that language in the Redline report? And Chris, if you have anything to add to that description?
Cheers, Graham. Hi, all. Chris Pelling for the record. Essentially, you cracked the nut there in its entirety. My concern was a requester who no longer has the right to be a requester, requesting information and therefore the or no longer having the authority to request that information. From what I could read, it's not covered anywhere in the final draft we have, and it should really be put in there on the basis to protect the PP client or PP customer. But certainly from the point of view of what I sent in on the 27th last Friday, we haven't had very much discussion on it at all, so I don't see it being an issue because nobody's raised it as being an issue, but obviously open to the floor.
Thanks, Chris, and I think the language you proposed was that so if you scroll down to 97, let me see if I can find. So it says the rights holder agrees to submit without prejudice to other potentially applicable jurisdictions, and the proposed change is that it would be the requester and trademark holder. I'm not sure if that's an and. It could be an and or. What we're really, I think, trying to get at is the person who's actually requesting the information. So it could be that requester just replaces rights holder. It's an and or. Does anyone else have thoughts on the and or in the annex one jurisdiction piece, page 97? Vicki Sheckler does. And then I see Steve. Vicki and Steve, please. Vicki first.
This is Steve. Can you hear me?
Yep.
Okay. I was just going to say that, as I recall, this was originally set at requester, making these, submitting to jurisdiction. And then I believe at Kathy's request, correct me if I'm wrong here, it was changed to right holder. And as I get it, Chris's suggestion now is that it should be both. I just want to clarify that I think that's what he's seeking, not a switchback, but to have requester and the right holder.
You're correct, Steve. Essentially, it's either. You know, both should be on there in the sense that, as I mentioned, if the requester no longer has the authority, then why should the rights holder be pursued for it when the requester is the one that's in the wrong?
Okay, thank you.
Vicki?
When I looked at that language again yesterday and thinking about Chris's comment, it seemed to me that requester was the right thing. I don't know if we have a strong feeling about it one way or the other, but when you asked, Graham, about and or, it seemed like requester really is what it is, because the requester either has the authority to bind the rights holder, in which case they're binding the rights holder, or they're going rogue, in which case you're going to go after the requester, but not a hard feeling one way or the other on it.
Great. Thanks, Vicki. I see Kathy's hand, which is good, because I think she might have been the source of some of that language. Kathy?
Actually, I just came into the call, and I'm trying to catch up, but I think there was an and or on the requester and the rights holder, and the idea is to make sure we grab the entire chain. I'm sure Chris already explained it, and I apologize for being late. Lots of traffic out there in a rainy D.C. But the idea is to have the full chain. So the requester may be going rogue. The requester may decide to publish the data. The rights holder is supposed to be responsible. We'd all agreed on that. But just grabbing the entire chain seems to make sense, and giving a common jurisdiction where everyone can be reached. Thanks. Is there anything in particular, Graham, that I can address that's been raised?
So I think we were at an and or where I think we were sort of at a requester, and that limited it somewhat to just the person.
No, we need the rights holder, and we've already agreed on the rights holder. The question here is whether to add the requester, which makes sense. It's an and.
Oh, it's an and.
It's an and. Absolutely.
Now that that's clarified, do we have something, any response there from Steve or Vicki on the and?
This is Steve. Again, I think I would agree with Vicki that it's hard to see why this is really necessary, but I don't think that we have an objection to saying rights holder and requester. Because the requester, is already asserting that it can bind the rights holder. And again, this is how it started out. It started out as requester, and then it became rights holder, and now it's both. And I think we're okay with that. At least I think I'm okay with that. I'll defer to anybody else that, especially from the sub-team who's been living with this intimately for several months.
Great. Thanks, Steve. And if anybody has further thoughts on that, and that was the time. We can come back to it later, but let's move on from there. I think we've got it. Next up is B, which is going to be definitional issues regarding privacy and proxy services. Do we have James Bladel on the call? I don't see him, if I'm wrong.
I am here. Hello.
Oh, good. Hey, James. So this is one that we've certainly spent considerable amounts of time on. And let's see if we can find the page in the report. Sorry, Mary, this is going to be a lot of searching documents for you.
I think it's page 7 in the clean version.
Let's see if we can find it in the... I've got it on page 8 in the marked-up version. Maybe James, you can explain your perspective on this, was it Vicki that sent a response through Mary? We can get to her. But anyway, please go ahead, James.
Thanks, Graham. James speaking, and hopefully you can hear me now. If I'm understanding, this is definitions. I was really wanting to focus the working group's attention on the top of page 8. the second the bullets in blue there about registrars shall not knowingly accept registrations from privacy or proxy service providers who are not accredited. Here's the issue. I mean, I think that knowingly is is an important concept. Obviously, we don't want to hold anyone accountable for something that they were not aware was occurring and that was not not reported to them. And I fully acknowledge that this may be a topic for implementation, but I just want to point out that knowingly, leaves the door wide open for ICANN compliance perhaps to interpret this inconsistently, and I think we should establish some guidance for the implementation of this requirement. Something along the lines of more detailed guidelines in terms of report, investigate, and act. Similar to what we have for invalid whois, similar for what we have for abuse, that this is not implying that registrars are to be, for example, screening registrations on the front end, referencing either an internal or an industry-shared blacklist of unaccredited or banned privacy services, and just generally thinking that the obligation extends to, hey, I've reported to you that this is an unaccredited privacy service, and you have acted upon that, usually in the way, we would refer to that. It would be similar to handling of an invalid whois report, which is, someone is saying that you're an unaccredited privacy service or proxy service. You can either A, demonstrate that you are accredited, or B, update your whois to reflect the actual data, further action, including suspension and deletion, would follow. I think the key here, though, is that we don't want to say that you should have known, you should have been aware, or it's up to ICANN to determine whether or not there is a shared directory of these services that registrars are to be referencing. Again, fully acknowledge that this is all an implementation concern at this point, but I wanted to get that into this group's attention here as we're closing out this report.
Great. Thanks, James. That's actually not where we were going with this, I thought. So we actually have two pieces to talk about then in this language. Steve is asking if in the chat if you're proposing entirely new language here. For this piece, I'm not sure that you are. I think what you're trying to get at is a detail around knowingly.
That's a good question. I think knowingly, the language is probably fine as is. I think that what I'm asking for, Steve, is some recognition in the report that we can put some constraints around the implementation of this, but the intention is not to create registries or blacklists of registrants that registrars are required to refer to in advance of registrations.
Okay. So that sounds to me like it could be a footnote. I've got Kathy and Vicky in the queue. Kathy?
Great. Thanks, Graham. I actually have a question for James about whether the following might solve or address the issue he's raising. So we're looking at the page where at the top it says, registrars are not to knowingly accept registrations, ... And then just below are bullet points that have definitions of words, publication, disclosure. So, James, would this help to put knowingly down there and say knowingly means actual notice or actual knowledge? And that way, that'll give some guidance to implement.
If I could respond, Graham. Graham,
sorry.
Okay. Please. Yeah, Kathy, that would be great. And I'd be happy to take a whack at that just by something along the lines of what you just said. Knowingly means, in a particular case, that a registrar was made aware through reports from ICANN or third parties that that particular registrant was, in fact, an unaccredited privacy or proxy service.
Great,
okay.
Thanks.
If you're going to take that on, you should be doing that very shortly. I see Vicky. Vicki, please.
In terms of saying that knowingly means actual knowledge, I don't think there's a problem with that approach since we want to get the report out. I wonder if that's something that's a footnote for implementation. Because Mary noted in the chat that doing that in this report may be more complicated in thinking about the unintended consequences that might come up from that. But I think having a footnote that it needs to be addressed in implementation might be a way to split the baby here, to hit James's point. My concern with this section is the third sentence, but based on what James just said, I'm not sure we even need the third sentence or the fourth sentence of that paragraph. If James' concern is just about knowingly, then I don't think we need to talk about when you're liable or not liable or when you're – it's liable is the word I think that's used in here, right?
It is. It is liable. And I think there was some discussion about whether the word like responsible would have been maybe a better term for this. James is agreeing with you, Vicki, that a footnote citing actual knowledge is acceptable. And Kathy is asking what question. So on page 8 in the first bullet point on that page of the not clean version, I think the third and fourth sentences are, in this regard, the working group notes that the consequence of this recommendation is that an accredited privacy proxy service provider that is in good standing with ICANN will therefore not be liable for the actions of their customers. Similarly, an individual or entity that is acting as a privacy or proxy service but not accredited by ICANN or not in good standing will be considered the registrant of record and thus responsible for the domain name registration in question.
Right, and so my point is that we should not in this document say when you are liable or not liable for stuff. So I would either take out those two sentences, or if we want to make it clear that if you're an individual or acting as a privacy proxy service but not accredited or not in good standing, that you are considered the registrant of record, I would end it there and not talk about responsibility or liability.
Thanks, Vicki. I think you have a good point. I think it is an interesting piece to note and perhaps quite important, but maybe we can find a way with this language now to make it acceptable. I see James has got his hand up in response, perhaps. James?
Yes, and thank you. Thanks to Vicki for pointing out that there was a second piece to this, which I had so long ago I'd actually forgotten. So I agree with Vicki that there's a bit of a paradox here in that we're establishing in the first bit consequences for registrars, and then we're establishing in the second bit consequences for these folks who are acting on behalf of others, undisclosed registrants or undisclosed customers. And, I think that it is important that we establish that if you are not accredited but you are registering a domain name on behalf of someone else, that you are, in fact, responsible. And I think that's – we dropped the word liable per Steve's concerns that were raised on the list. I think that is sensible to drop the word – to drop the reference to liability. But I think it is okay to establish that we are – responsible. I think that may be covered under the ICANN definition of registered name holder, but if it's not, then we can say something along the lines of dropping that last sentence and something like where we're saying here that an individual or entity that is acting as a privacy proxy service but is not accredited by ICANN or is not in good standing will be considered the registrant of record or the responsible registered name holder, something along those lines. It's fine if we want to drop that last phrase and just focus on the word responsible rather than liable.
Okay, and delete the third sentence as well.
The third sentence.
The one that talks about whether a privacy proxy service in good standing is liable or not liable for the actions of their customer.
It's the James. It's the inverse of what we just talked about. So we're saying two things here. One, we're saying if you're accredited and you're good, you're not responsible for the registration. And if you're unaccredited, you are therefore the registrant of record and you are responsible. So
yeah.
Both sides here.
Yeah, I think we need one or the other.
No, I disagree with that. I think this was included in here to address the lawyer issue, and I think it's fine to say if you're not an accredited privacy proxy server, you will be considered the registrant of record because that's the case, right? Period.
Yep.
Now, if you're a privacy proxy server and that's accredited, in most cases you will not be liable for your customer, but there are cases where you will be, and we shouldn't presuppose when it is or it isn't, and liability is something for a court to decide, not this.
So I think we are trying to get away from the word liable. I don't think anybody's interested in the word liable anymore.
Right.
Right, but I wouldn't say not responsible either, because you don't know the rest of the facts.
I guess maybe responsible there is not quite the right phrase either. It could be that we maybe need to state clearly that it's not the registrant of record, not the registered name holder.
I have no problem saying not the registrant of record, because that's a factual determination. And I think that's true.
It's obvious.
So if we want to stick to registrant of record, you are or you aren't, no problem.
You could say is not considered the registered name holder or the registrant of record.
I mean,
okay.
I mean,
because I believe those two...
I feel like James is saying something. I have Todd in the queue. I think maybe we just got a place to where we needed to be. And then Mary's asking questions. Let's hear from Todd.
Thanks, Todd Williams, for the record. I think a lot of what I was going to say has just been covered. But basically, the third and fourth sentences are going to two different things, and I'm not really sure that they are the inverse of each other. You know, the fourth sentence saying, if you are unaccredited, you will be considered the registrant of record, I don't think is, you know, particularly in dispute. It's somewhat redundant of the second sentence, but I think just to the extent that it clarifies the second, that's helpful. But I think the third, and maybe this is what Vicky was going towards, is actually quite different, and, you know, whether it's liable or responsible or what, I think it opens a kind of can of worms that we're not really wanting to go down at this juncture. But, I mean, that's largely already been said by everybody else. Thanks.
Thanks, Todd. I see no other hands in the queue, although I did see Steve's earlier. I think we're reasonably close here that last sentence I think we can work with, and then it's that third that we're going to, and maybe we have to take this offline, it isn't necessarily ideal, but see if we can reformulate that into not the registered name holder, and then we need to look, as Mary is noting in the chat, about how that might impact the RAA. I see Vicky and Steve. Vicky?
I mean, just to close it out, from my perspective, you know, using the term registrant of record, I think is fine, provided it doesn't have the issues that Mary's mentioning, because I don't know what those issues are.
Thanks, Vicky. Steve?
So, if I understand, I'm sorry, I got cut off, or I cut myself off there briefly, but is what's on the table with regard to the third sentence that it would say that the consequence of the recommendation is that the accredited privacy or proxy service provider is not considered the registered name holder?
That was my understanding of where we got to, yep.
Yeah, I'm not sure what the consequences of that are. I really think that the essence of what we're trying to convey is in the first two sentences here. The knowingly point, and we'll have that footnote to kind of buttress that, and to say, you know, we know there will be people who are doing this even though they're not accredited. And the RAA says they are the registered name holder, and a lot of things flow from that. So I'm just not sure whether we can really address the topic of the third sentence without actually altering you know, what the RIAA provides. I do think we definitely need to, as I think Vicki has said, we want to get the reference to liability out of there, because that kind of implies we're allocating the responsibilities of third parties and so forth. But I'm just still not clear what the third sentence provides that would not be, you know, does this have some unintended consequences as far as the RIAA is concerned? So I guess what I'm asking, James, is in order for us to actually wrap up today, would he be open to the dropping the third sentence, or maybe dropping the third and fourth sentence, so that we don't run that risk of really trying to create a lot of consequences within the RIAA framework that we may not be intending? And don't the first two sentences really, with the footnote about knowingly, really convey what it is we want to cover? Thanks.
Hey, Steve. And James has his hand up next. James?
Thanks, Graham. I'm just kind of visualizing what Steve just proposed, and I had another question. While I think about that, the other question that I had was the acknowledgement that we are sort of creating a paradox here, which is that we're establishing for unaccredited privacy proxy services that they are the registrant, the registered name holder, and they are responsible, but that they are also, that their registrar is obligated to take action against them, according to the first section, if it's reported. So we're almost on one hand saying, you know, registrars, you shall not allow this condition to exist, and then in the last sentence saying, and if, by the way, if this condition exists, then these following definitions apply. So I think that stepping back from this, that also starts to lend some weight to what Steve is saying about dropping some of the latter sentences, because I believe it does confuse that first one. So the question then to the working group is, well, what do we want to happen here? If someone is acting as an unaccredited privacy service, do we want them to be responsible, or do we want the registrar, upon reporting of that, do we want the registrar to ferret those folks out and suspend those domain names? And what do we want to happen? Because it seems like we're saying both.
That's a good point, James. Thank you. I see Vicky's got her hand up.
Sorry, I didn't mean to. I'm still thinking about it.
Okay.
Sorry.
So, Graham, sorry.
I've got Steve and Kathy in the queue. Maybe we'll let them, and you can come back, James.
Yeah, this is Steve. Todd has already said this in the chat. I don't think those two are contradictory, James. I think if the registrar doesn't know about it, then the registrar obviously doesn't have any obligation to take any action. But in that case, the unaccredited entity that is registering domain names on behalf of another is under 377. They're the registered name holder, and they have a lot of obligations, warranties, and things like that that they have to get. If and when the registrar finds out about it, or, you know, knows, meets the definition of knowingly, and obviously there may be implementation questions about when that occurs, but once that happens, then yes, the registrar has the obligation under the RIAA not to knowingly accept registrations from unaccredited parties that are registering on behalf of others. So, you know, then it should take action. So I don't really see anything contradictory in those two paths. One occurs before the registrar has knowledge, and going forward from there. The other only occurs after the registrar has knowledge. So I'm not sure that I see the contradiction. Thanks.
Thanks, Steve. I've got Kathy, James, and then Don in the queue. Kathy?
I'm going to ask Steve a question. I have what I was going to say, but, well, Steve, I have a question for you, which is, I thought this language was to address lawyers as well as others who might
yes.
be registering for children and minors and small businesses in their community. Wow. So let me ask you, based on what you just said, does that mean that a registrar who recognizes a pattern of a law firm registering a number of domain names that clearly are not for the law firm, let's say they have to do with trademarks or brands, that when that comes to their actual knowledge or notice, they have to drop those registrations? I thought the purpose of this language was to allow those registrations to continue, but flag the responsibility of the named registrant for the registration, not necessarily the liability of the content. We're not saying that Google's liable for everything that all the emails under gmail.com are used for. That's a court matter, but I thought it was the responsibility of the registrant that allows some of the proxies, the unaffiliated, unaccredited proxies, to go through.
Yeah, no, I can't. This is Steve, if I can just respond. I think you're correct. It's really just stressing that in that circumstance, when you look at who is the registered name holder, the law firm can't say, well, I don't have to respond to data reminder policy notice, or I don't have to, I can put that on my client. The registered name holder has those responsibilities under the contract. So that is what they are responsible, what they are responsible to do.
So now, we're not asking the providers to drop them. Sorry.
No, we're not asking the providers to drop them.
That's
so I hope that clarifies that. Thank you for raising that question.
And I'll get back in the queue if I need to make any more points on this, Graham. Thanks.
Thanks.
Thanks, Kathy. Thanks, Steve. I'll just as a point, I'm not sure the language says we would have to service providers have to start dropping registrations. It sounds like they'd be able to take new ones. Is perhaps an important distinction. James?
Hey, Graham. James speaking, and just coming back to the exchange there between Kathy and Steve, and I agree that this is taking us to a place I don't think any of us want to go. For example, and I think they raised the scenario of, through a UDRP or some other action, we determine that a particular registrant contact object is in fact an unaccredited privacy or proxy service. And to Steve's point just a moment ago, maybe we don't have to necessarily take action against any other names that may be managed by that registrant, but we may be, according to the strictest reading of this language, we may be prohibited from taking new registrations or inbound transfers from that particular registrant without getting sideways with the RAA. So my question to this group is, if we are satisfied with the, taking out the third section and just establishing that unaccredited providers are the registrant of record, do we really gain anything from this first sentence? Registrars are not knowingly accepting registrations from privacy or proxy service providers who are not accredited. Do we gain anything here? It addresses my concern about knowingly and when they should have known and who should have informed them, et cetera. But it also addresses this significant side effect where law firms or other services that register on behalf of third parties would find themselves locked out of future registrations by a registrar who feels that their hands are tied by this first sentence. So just putting that out there on the table, that the way out here might be to reinforce the second and fourth sentence and drop the first. Thank you.
Thanks, James. That's an interesting idea that I have a sneaking suspicion we're going to need a little bit more time than just at this moment to parse. And we've also spent about 36 minutes so far in the call, and we have plenty more to get to that I would like to. So what I think we for the moment is have a think about what James just suggested, which is to drop 1 and 3 and keep 2 and 4. And we'll need to think about that pretty darn quick. And people should probably start doing that as we're on the call, but that might be a way forward. So unless there's any more on that particular piece, we should move on to B.
Sorry, I'll take my hand down.
All right. Seeing no hands, let's move on. So this is customer notification as part of de-accreditation. This was suggested by Darcy. Thank you. And I don't have the page reference on me or in front of me. But my understanding of this issue is that the language for when we were notifying customers was breach notice. And that wasn't entirely appropriate because it could have been an administrative breach or don't want to say immaterial, but the breach wasn't going to result in the de-accreditation. There seemed to be pretty uniform agreement that that was okay and that notification should go out once ICANN has decided to de-accredit that service provider. Page 18 says Mary in the red line. If I can find that. Find that specific language. Don't see it on the actual page. Oh, Mary, I think, has put it into the chat for us. Privacy Proxy Service customer should be notified in advance of de-accreditation of a Privacy and Proxy Service provider. And I think that's all we were trying to get to. I think that point is understood. And I don't think there was any disagreement there. So I think we're probably okay with moving on from that suggestion, unless anybody has any issue there.
Yep.
Oh, I see Kathy's got her hand up. Kathy?
Yeah, thanks, Graham. I'm trying to figure out the language that Mary put into the chat room. Is that the language that Darcy circulated? Because I thought there was 30 days in Darcy's note. In the email she circulated yesterday, that we were promising or committing to a procedure that involved a fixed amount of time, a minimum of a fixed amount of time, so that customers would get the notice and then have time to move their privacy and proxy registrations to another place and protect their privacy. So how did can we put back in the time? And I think we were trying to align that with the RAA and de-accreditation of registrars and the type of notice that's provided to registrants. Thanks.
Thanks, Kathy. Right. Steve is agreeing. I don't know if we have a response from Mary about the timing in there. And I see Mike Zupke's got his hand up. Mike, please.
Thanks, Graham. So this is Mike from staff. And Mary had sort of discussed this with me yesterday, kind of trying to use our experience with the registrar accreditation agreement as a guide. And so when we looked at it, one of the thoughts that came to mind was this would sort of bind us to some contractual language that we might not fully want to keep. So while we didn't, as staff, we didn't have any issue with there being some 30-day notice procedure or even longer perhaps. One thought was, what if we say, okay, fine, the termination becomes effective in 30 days. That still gives somebody who's been given notice they're terminated the opportunity to bring more customers in to potentially do more harm. So we're thinking rather than have a hard rule of saying, you get a termination notice and it's not effective for 30 days, we might want to say, you get a termination notice and you can't take on new business immediately or you can't call yourself accredited immediately, but, your customers would have some period of time to, take some action before potential reveal of their data. So that was at least, my thinking was we didn't necessarily want to say the termination doesn't become effective, but rather the customer would have some opportunity to take an action before their data would be revealed against their will. Make sense?
One to go without dressing.
Thanks, Mike. I've got Kathy and Darcy.
Why don't I yield to Darcy?
Okay. Darcy?
Darcy Southwell for the record. I think Mike, we're aligned there. There were a number of emails yesterday that talked about. I mean, the idea here was that the language that we'd be notifying customers during the breach process was the real problem. And so we don't expect that once a termination is given or issued that we would ever want them to take on new privacy customers, but that there's that transition period. So I think Kathy just posted the language in the chat that we'd proposed, and many of us have seemed comfortable with at least, or at least some of us, I should say. So I just wanted to clarify that. We're not expecting that they would get to continue, but we just don't want to be any sort of obligation that they're going to contact customers during the breach when termination and deaccreditation may never happen. Thanks.
Thanks, Doris. Yeah, I think that's clear. So not sure. We'll need to check the language, but I think everybody's more or less agreed that no one thinks they should get more registrations after they've been deaccredited, but we need to make sure that there's enough time for customers to make some choices. Steve's floating some language in the chat.
Can I, Graham, can I get my turn back?
Sure. Yes, please.
Great. I wanted to ask Mike a question, whether he sees any concerns in the language I just posted, which is Darcy's language. And I also wanted to share with him, in case it hadn't been passed on to ICANN staff, that there may be more difficulties in moving privacy and proxy providers than there are in moving registrars. And everybody correct me if I'm wrong, but that it may not all registrars will take all accredited privacy and proxy providers. So it may take some research for customers to find what may be both a new proxy privacy provider and, unfortunately, a new registrar as well. So that could actually – I mean, we need – 30 days seems like a minimum, and so it would be nice to kind of, you know, write that in. Thanks.
Thanks, Kathy. Mike, did you have a thought there?
I think the language that Kathy pasted is what I looked at earlier. And I think it's a little bit too prescriptive. It says deaccreditation doesn't become effective until 30 days after the notice of termination. To me, that's really, you know, a matter of implementation. I think that the recommendation, and as we understand it, I think we all want the same thing, as you've said, is, you know, there be some grace period before the customers are affected by a termination. And similarly, the notion that there not be a notice to the customers before the termination decision is basically final. You know, we're in agreement with that. I just think saying that the termination isn't effective until 30 days after the notice is really more of a implementation matter. And I think, you know, there's some nuance in that. Like I say, we might want to, you know, have some transition period, but also have a period during which they couldn't do new business. So my suggestion would be to make the recommendation about, you know, the timing of the notice and about making sure consumers have a chance to get out before there's a mandatory reveal. But I don't think putting in what is essentially contractual language might necessarily be ideal.
Thanks, Mike. Point taken. And Steve is making a point in the chat that we can add language around existing customers. So that deaccreditation become effective for existing customers 30 days after notice of termination. And no one has a problem with the using new registrations there. Trying to decide on whether we need to keep that 30 days or not. I think we've captured the breach termination distinction well, so that's going to be okay. And it could be that we put in language that is a little less prescriptive, but just ensures that registrants have a reasonable amount of time to react to the termination and leave that for implementation. I'm not sure how Kathy would feel about something like that. Only Steve's language without the 30-day note. I'm okay with Steve's language. It's really this. It says 30 days apparently in the RRA in the RAA. Says Kathy. And I think it is sensible to have to give people that amount of time because there are considerable risks in the accreditation of a privacy and proxy service. I have to find myself in an impasse for making a judgment call on that. I see Steve typing, and Darcy still has a hand up. Darcy, is that an old hand?
No, sorry about that. I'm done.
Okay. I see Mary's hand up. Mary?
Yes, thanks, Graham, and hi, everybody. This is Mary from staff. So following up on Mike's point, I mean, just looking at the discussion, it seems to us that the point here, as I put in the chat, is to give the customers the opportunity not just to know of what might be happening, but then you provide an escape that might take some doing. So we don't actually set in principle one. Now maybe we add a lines of the language. We're just wondering whether actually 30 days is necessary.
Breaking up.
Yeah, you're breaking up and becoming quite difficult to hear in there. It was almost gettable, but maybe not quite. I don't know if you want to try repeating yourself again, or you may need to reconnect. What I am seeing in the chat is considerable agreement with Steve's proposed language, and so we might move forward with that. I've got Kathy's hand up, and then maybe we can come back to Mary.
Great. Yeah, this is Kathy, and agreement with Steve's language. This is a recommendation of the working group for existing customers, 30 days after notice of termination. Again, I'm thinking this is a minimum, not a maximum. It is following the RAA, and so I'd love to send that very clear recommendation. It's not a mandate, it's a recommendation. So I think it should go in there because I think we're going to find people having to do a lot of research here, or at least some, and we've got to let them have the time to do it. So, you know, in case anybody doesn't know, you know, 10 years from now what we intended, let's let them know very clearly. Thanks.
Thanks, Kathy. Mary is suggesting in the chat that we add specific language to say notify customers before termination becomes effective, but not specify 30 days.
But you know what?
Really what we're discussing right now is whether we have to specify 30 days or not. Steve?
Yeah, my only point was I understand Mary's point. This is an implementation point. I agree with that. I just don't see that there's a downside to saying as an implementation recommendation, we recommend 30 days. For existing customers. Now, when it comes to when the implementation team rolls up its sleeves and works on this, they may find reasons that doesn't work or needs to be modified in some way. But I just think there seems to be a fair amount of sentiment within the group that we think 30 days sounds about right. So I'm not sure what the downside is to putting that in labeled as an implementation recommendation. Thanks.
Thanks, Stephen, and I agree and think perhaps that's the way we move forward is that we phrase it that way and we keep that 30 days and we move forward. And I see Plato's agreeing in the chat. And Mary's got it. I still see hands. Nope. Kathy's still got a hand up and Steve has a hand up, although I suspect both of those are old.
What?
Someone needs to mute their mic. Sounds like they're driving, too. This is too serious work to be driving and privacy and proxy. Okay, so that gets us through that one. What is up next? That's D. Is labeling in who is regarding knowledge of registrar of record, and this is a suggestion from Luke. Let's see if I can go back and find Luke's email, and we had a good response from Steve on some of his suggestions. Page 9, I suspect, on the page 10. Thanks, Mary. You've been getting ahead of this. And this was around labeling. Excuse me. Labeling privacy and proxy registrations. And we've got a change here to the extent that this is feasible. Domain name registrations involve privacy proxy services should be clearly labeled as section here. And I think that's a reasonable change. I don't know that anyone has any concerns with that. Any concerns? Seeing none, that's good. Let's move on to
James.
Sorry, Graham. James here.
Oh, you waited just that amount of time. Please, go ahead.
Hey, oh, no, I'm just a little slow on the
hand raised. Sorry about that. Just reading the footnote 14, I think this is broader discussion as implementation, but as part of the implementation work. But some internal discussions have yielded significant concerns about creating new fields in Whois to identify privacy proxy services. So I believe that this recommendation is important and should be preserved, but perhaps we should note that wherever possible, we should use existing fields in Whois. Thanks.
Thanks, James. And you're right, adding a new field to Whois is no joke. We've certainly talked about that in the past. And I'm fine with such a recommendation. That seems sensible as well. I've got Don's hand up. Don, go ahead.
Sorry, it took a minute to unmute. Maybe being hyper-technical here, but I'd suggest adding or replacing Whois with something like domain name registration database, because Whois may be a dead term before long.
Thanks, Don. I'm okay with that, so that we can change that to maybe Whois and or RDAP or similar thing. And James, also maybe that's worth adding to the footnote that wherever possible, existing fields should be used as an implementation note again. Any other thoughts on this issue? I see Michele's got his hand up. Michele.
Thanks, Michele, for the record. Yeah, I think there was in the 2013 contract, there is actual wording there which replaces Whois, which I recommend be used just for the sake of consistency. I obviously can't remember the exact wording, but I would agree with Don that you referred to Whois specifically is probably a very bad idea. Actually, here it is. It's Registration Data Directory Service, brackets Whois. So I think it's just a matter of revising wherever the terminology is used and just looking at replacing it with something more comprehensive. Thanks.
Thanks, Michele. Don, your hand is still up, but I'm assuming that's old. There seems to be agreement there. Luke is saying in the chat that it's only if a registrar has knowledge about it, and it's not just if it's feasible, the registrar needs to be aware. I think what we're making this recommendation for accredited privacy and proxy providers, not for registrars. And so these are registrations from a privacy and proxy service provider, and they would know all of the privacy and proxy registrations they're providing. So I'm not sure that applies. But I think we've captured what we need to capture here. Let me just check the chat. Okay. I think Mary's got that, and we can move on to E, application of PS standard to privacy and proxy providers designated point of contact. And Luke's point here was that I think, don't want to exactly copy PX because that specifies replies within 4 hours, and that's quite an obligation. Steve had a good response, I think, as well here, which was that we're not trying to directly copy PX, just that it should be similar. And I guess we're trying to decide if similar is okay, and that language is acceptable. I see Steve's hand up, and while Steve's talking, I'm going to see if I can find the page reference. Steve?
Yeah, my only point there was that I think we were fairly careful in how we phrased this, and I think Luke read it more broadly, because we were just talking about what this contact is capable of or authorized to do. That's why the TAC example came up, not because it has to respond within 4 hours or something like that. So, and I think it basically says that it's It has to do with the capability and authorization. This is recommendation 14, which is on page 13 of the clean version. Capable and authorized, to do a standard similar to that currently required for a TX. It doesn't say anything about the time frame of response. So I think we're okay with that. Thanks.
Thanks, Steve. So Luke is suggesting in the chat to keep capable and authorized and remove TX, and Volker is suggesting abuse contact would be a better simile. Abuse contact may well be a better does anyone else have thoughts on that rather than TX?
Graham, this is Steve.
Go ahead.
Yeah, thanks. You know, I don't remember who brought up TX here, whether it was the staff or I suspect it was probably registrars that brought it up. The reason I don't remember is because this language has been stable for over a year. And it's kind of disturbing that last night people say they shouldn't reference it. I'm fine looking out TX.
You're breaking up quite a bit there, and you sound a bit far away.
Hello?
Try again? I'm not sure. We may have lost Steve there. I think I'm hearing Steve, though, or at least I was gathering the point that this has been language that's been in there for a long time. And Steve is Karaki's coming back in. And so I guess the wording is capable and authorized as standard similar to TAAC. Could we say TAAC or the abuse point of contact? And maybe that. Maybe that covers us there if we say either or. I see McKaylee and then Don, and then we'll see if Steve's connected again. McKaylee?
Thanks, McKaylee, for records and stuff. I'm looking at the chat, and I think what Mary said, like designated point of contact, abuse contact, something like that. I mean, I think maybe this is up to implementation. I think, you know, the fact that we may have made a reference to TAAC originally was probably just because we everybody agreed, hey, there's a system, there's a process, we've used that as a point of reference, we didn't feel that we needed to flesh it out any further. But obviously at this juncture, we don't really want to refer to TAAC, and I mean, it's a totally different thing, and it comes with a whole different set of requirements. Speaking for my own company, abuse contact is something which will get handled, and there's a process for that. I'm sure a lot of other registrars are probably in a similar position, but maybe not all are. Thanks.
Thanks, McKaylee. I'm hearing strongly from registrars or service providers in here that TAAC is maybe a little too specific, and that abuse contact might be more meaningful. And I think McKaylee made the point in there that this is. Essentially what we're doing here is providing implementation guidance of what it kind of should be like. So it seems reasonable to me that we can make a couple suggestions for what a capable and authorized point of contact is like, and maybe that doesn't have to specifically be TX. And Darcy's weighing in here as well. Does anybody reject to removing TAAC and specifying something like domain abuse, or do we just leave it as capable and authorized? I've got Don in the queue, and then we'll come back to Steve. Don?
Appreciate it. Just responding to something was said, I think this probable final call is a good time to go back and look at things we might have forgotten, even were in there over the course of a year plus. I would suggest removing TAAC, though. Nothing against it, but there's always a risk of, even as a suggestion, tying ourselves to a set of standards that could change. Yeah, that could change by the very nature of the standard setting.
Okay. Thanks, Don. And I there doesn't seem to be any real specific support for TAC. And so capable and authorized is really the piece that's important, and we can drop the reference to TAC specifically. I think we can move on. Steve?
Graham, so we're just talking about dropping the parenthetical here. So we just it would end at information request received. I'm fine with that. Thank you.
Great. Okay. Awesome. And we get to move on from there into requirement of verification in recommendation 17, also from Luke. This was another issue that Steve responded to Luke's email on. Fourth bullet point, page 17, doesn't allow for a third party to perform the email address verification. We were going to cross-reference recommendation 5 as per Steve's suggestion, and Mary is saying this is the bottom of 15 in the red line version. Oh, sorry, top of 16, says Mary. Let me see if I can find that. Steve, is that a new hand or an old hand?
I think it's the top of 15. If I understood what Luke's concern was, it's about triggering the obligation for verification and re-verification.
Okay.
I still can't find it. It doesn't sound like it was.
I think it's the top of 15. When a service provider becomes aware of a persistent delivery failure to a customer, that will trigger the PP service provider's obligation to perform a verification, re-verification as applicable, et cetera. It kind of refers back to our recommendation about validation and verification. If I understand Luke's concern, it was that if you read this literally, if someone else performs that verification, then the privacy proxy service provider is not in compliance. Is that your concern, Luke?
I see him typing. Yep, he's got it. You agree?
Okay. Yeah, I mean, I think we can make a cross-reference to Recommendation 5, which makes it clear that if you gives the example of a provider who is affiliated with a registrar, then the registrar may be doing the verification, re-verification. The provider doesn't have to do it again. So I think I would think that would clarify, hopefully that would address Luke's concern.
I get the impression that it does, and that seems reasonable to me. And unless there's any more thoughts on that, we'll keep going. Oh, lots of agreement there. Great. The last thing was a suggestion from Luke about accreditation fees. which I enjoyed as a suggestion, but I agree with Steve's response that that's probably an implementation issue, and I'm not sure that we can make that recommendation or not, because it really depends on what the regime ends up looking like. Ambitious addition. I see Holly's hand up.
Not for this issue, just to ask, are we going to? I made some very minor recommendations, but are they going to be adopted?
I have that on my list to talk about next.
Okay, fine. Thanks.
Luke saying, if you don't try, so I think we can all move on from that one, unless anyone else has thoughts about making reference to potential fees. Bradle's pointing out in the chat that it's noteworthy high fees would be prohibitive for accreditation and more privacy and proxy services than they remain unaccredited, which is not a scenario we want, but I still think that's pretty strong in the implementation. So that brings us to the end of G, but I do have H and I, and H was appropriately for Holly's proposed edits, as she just mentioned. One was being a bit more consistent around beneficial user, customer, registered name holder, use of the term affiliated and its definition, and forward versus relay. And I don't think there's any controversy about those. And
no.
The point I'm seeing from Mary in the chat is that it sounds like those have been adopted. So thank you, Holly, for the close reading. That's appreciated.
Thank you.
I have an I, too, which was transfers and whether the removing the privacy proxy does not constitute a material change in registered name holder and therefore prevent the 60-day lock from applying. I haven't been following that issue too closely, so I'm not 100% sure that's resolved or not. I see James has his hand up. That's perfect. James, please.
Yeah, thanks, Graham. This is James, and I'll speak to that just briefly here. And again, it is likely something that is not of major concern, except to the registrars and providers that will have to implement this. But the recently, 2012, concluded IRTPC transfer working group and its implementation team, which wrapped up its work and will be scheduled to implement in August of next year, touches on the use of privacy services as whether or not adding or removing a privacy proxy service constitutes a change of registrant and triggers a couple of things, a re-verification of the data, whether it triggers consent from both parties, both the service and the underlying customer, and then also implements the 60-day lock against subsequent transfers. And through the implementation, we went back and forth on this extensively through the implementation of that transfer policy. And I think where we landed was, and folks, please correct me if I'm wrong, is that registrars are going to need to have some degree of flexibility here in determining whether or not a adding or removing or canceling a privacy service crosses that threshold and triggers this other policy and all of its other downstream requirements. So item number one, I would be very careful about this group, PPSAI, wading into those waters and disrupting something that took, a number of years to sort of sort out and untangle. But secondly, I think that the concern that I would have is that if registrars were too tightly bound to one approach or another, that they would, it would create a lot of negative consequences that we really don't want to address. So my recommendation is that privacy proxy accreditation stay out of the issues of transfers in terms of whether or not it triggers the IRTPC change of registrant process. And then leave that to the registrars as the flexibility that was determined under that transfer policy, and not duplicate or even create incompatible requirements under this policy. Thanks.
Thanks, James. That's pretty sensible. Having that locked in place would be a serious problem for many people, I think. I've got Amy's hand, excuse me, and then Kathy. Amy?
Hi, this is Amy. We just wanted to point out, we just wanted to go back to the language of the transfer policy, because if you look at it, I'll paste it in the chat, the transfer policy seems to be pretty clear on this, we think, in reading it, that so the registered name holder data is, the privacy or proxy data, if that's what's in WHOIS. And if you look at how material change is defined, it defines it as a change to the registered name holder's name or organization, It's not a typographical correction. Any change that is accompanied by a change of address or phone number, or any change to the email address. And so the way we read it is that, you know, if that information changes because the privacy proxy service is removed or changed, then that would be a change.
I think what James is saying, and I would agree with them, that could be considerably problematic.
So let me take this in two steps, if I could, Graham.
Yep. I've got you can respond, and then I've got Kathy in the queue, and then I think...
Graham, I'm on a slightly different issue, so I'd love to hear James's response and the discussion with Amy. Thanks.
Great. Just briefly, we've got about 18 minutes left. We're not going to get to going through the executive summary, but we do need to hear from Mary about next steps and consensus calls. So that's my encouragement to keep this a little brief. Thank you.
So thanks, James. I'll be brief. Maybe we can agree in this group that this issue belongs in the transfer policy implementation and not part of the privacy proxy implementation. And then we can take this other issue and continue. Because, you know, just bluntly to Amy and Mike, that is not where I understood this, you know, years of the IRTPC to work. For example, we had a number of discussions about people changing, non-typographical, non-material changes, and apparently that was disregarded by staff. So we can have that conversation somewhere else and not entangle the privacy proxy PPSAI work in that other issue. Thanks.
Thanks, James. And Zuck keeps saying that he got bumped off the call. I think that's probably sage advice, which would be to not mess with any of that particular transfer policy inside of PPSAI. Kathy?
Okay, so let me ask James the question I was going to ask him, but it may be a question for Mike or Graham, for you or Amy, which is from a customer perspective, what's happening here? And what are we debating when, so we move proxy privacy providers, in a sense, what should we be kind of teaching customers to look for? Every time there is a revalidation or re-verification, there is, of course, the chance that might be lost in spam and other things. So can somebody just walk me through the different possibilities, the different scenarios from a customer perspective that we're looking at, with the different scenarios people much more expert than I am have in their heads? Thanks.
Thanks, Mary.
Graham, this is James. In the interest of time, I would volunteer to address that with Kathy offline, because it is fairly extensive. Thanks. And this is and I see Mike's post to the chat that this cake is already baked, and if so, then I think registrars have some more work to do because that's not exactly how we would see it. Thanks.
Great. Thanks, James. And I'm sure Kathy will be happy to pick you up on that particular offer. And this certainly does sound like an issue that is reasonably outside of the scope of PPSAI and possibly will raise the ire of registrars. So let's put that one aside for now, and maybe let's hear from Mary before we run out of time about next steps.
Hi, this is Mary. I hope that I'm coming across more clearly this time.
Much.
Okay, thank you. Sorry, I'm on a bad connection here. I'm away from my usual workspace. But, before I do that, just real quick, Graham, because I think most of the discussion on the list and today have captured if not all, of the substantive changes that were made to the recommendations. So much of what's left in the executive summary that are changes are mostly clarifications of language or additions at the request of the working group following Dublin discussions and so on. I just wanted to highlight that there's a couple of recommendations that don't seem to staff to be controversial because, again, they come from the working group's subsequent deliberations in Dublin and after. But I just wanted to point out for those with limited time that as you go through the executive summary, some of these new additional ones would be in recommendation 19, 20, and the general recommendations, and they concern things like having a periodic review post-implementation, maintaining statistics, and things like that that came out of Dublin. As to next steps, the consensus call per the work plan is to close on Monday, and the date of submission of the final report to the council, the last day for the December council meeting is actually Tuesday. So the staff will try our best to incorporate the changes that were agreed on today into the report. We think we've got some pretty clear notes as to what they are. It will help before we actually do that. We can send a note to the list summarizing what we think they are. But following that, we would then send a final reminder to the list to say, you know, the consensus call is ongoing. It closes Monday. And please, if you can, to indicate as a working group member whether or not you support all the recommendations. You know, if by the close of Monday we don't, you know, get statements of support, the presumption is that there is support. If, of course, you do not, please indicate that expressly as far as in advance of Monday as possible, and do indicate expressly what the recommendation is that you don't agree with so that we can indicate that in the final report that that particular recommendation did not get full consensus. Because anything that we don't indicate had an objection or non-support would be full consensus as is currently phrased. Finally, and I think the chair did write to the list about this, in terms of anyone who disagrees with any of the recommendations, if you or a group that you're representing would like to submit a minority statement, again, those need to be in by Monday, but preferably they should really be sent to the list before that as much as possible so people can see what the objection is detailed to be. Graham, that's kind of all that is from us. I hope that was clear, but we can, of course, answer any questions in the few minutes that remain.
Thank you, Mary. Does anyone have any questions for Mary? And I see a couple of people typing. So while we're typing, let's do this. We've got about 11 minutes left. We're not going to have time to go through all of the executive summary. So what I would like to do is ask if anybody has any other issues that we haven't raised today, either in the executive summary or not. Is there any thoughts on this report that anybody else has? And it is also worth noting that we still need to come back to 2B, and we need to do that very quickly. So what do I see in the chat here? I see that we're seeking quick confirmation that agreement is a personal agreement of participants in the working group, not an official statement of the stakeholder groups. So I guess that's a question for you, Mary, about what kind of statements people are submitting. Mary?
Oh, I'm sorry. Grandma, were you referring to Kathy's question? So, of course, groups can send in minority statements. We've had those in the past, but just to clarify that as a working group member, everybody is, of course, an individual participant.
Okay, thank you. I think that answers Kathy's question. Vicky is mentioning in the chat around the page 8 paragraph and definitions that we talked about pretty early on in the call that we still haven't quite resolved yet. I see Steve's got his hand up, and this is still another call.
Yes,
we've got 9 minutes or so for any other issues. Steve?
Yeah, I don't have another issue to raise. I just wanted to point out that I think it's looking at our agenda, 2A through the other two you added, I guess, H and I. I know that, I think we've, and I guess I'd like the staff to confirm, that we've come to rest on all of these except for B, which is the one that Vicki just referred to. And I'm not sure we've come to rest on the last item, the IRTP material change issue. Are those the only two where we haven't pretty much got this nailed down?
That's my understanding. I see Mary's hand up. Mary?
Thanks, Steve. Thanks, Graham. Yes, that is the staff's understanding based on the discussion today as well.
Okay. So in with regard to B, just again to review where we are, I had asked James whether he would agree to drop the last two sentences of those four sentences. We would be adding a footnote about knowingly from the first sentence. And his, immediate response, reflecting that everybody needs a few minutes off the call perhaps to think about this, was to say, why don't we drop the first and third sentence and just keep the second and fourth sentence? You know, drop the first sentence about registrars not knowingly accepting registrations from non-accredited services. And again, just having thought about that during the call here, I don't think I would be comfortable doing that because if you go back and look at the RAA, you see that in the interim specification on privacy proxy, it says basically that they will, that registrars will not knowingly take registrations outside the scope of the policy. But it doesn't, there are some provisions in the RAA, for example, regarding resellers that say they won't knowingly take registrations outside the scope of the policy if the policy says that. So I think we need to say that. I mean, I'm just not sure how we can avoid having that sentence, and I think the knowingly footnote helps to clarify what exactly the registrars are and aren't obligated to do. So I guess I would just ask, and I know that within 6 minutes we probably aren't going to resolve this, but could James and others consider whether we could just go with those first two sentences with the footnote about knowingly, which I think we're all pretty much in agreement on. So that's where I think this is, that's kind of the decision that I hope we can make, today. At the latest, and kind of come to closure on that issue. I don't have anything to say on the 2I issue, the material change, but I think on 2B that would be my proposal. Thanks.
Thanks, Steve. That's helpful. Stephanie is looking for the opportunity to reread the document. I'm sure we're going to get a next version of this with the stuff we've talked about today as soon as possible. And I've got James with his hand up in response to Steve. James?
Hi, Grant speaking. So to Steve's questions, if we can move the material change out of this, or maybe if Mike is saying that is a closed book, then maybe we need to continue to work on it here. But as far as the sections about knowingly, I would ask Mary if she could perhaps put that section up to the list, and then I'll propose some modifications to it. Actually, Steve, I was trying to see the issue through the eyes of a law firm and the potential trap that could be built in by that first sentence, in that once a registrar or provider becomes aware that a law firm is acting in the capacity of an unaccredited service, it would have, either an obligation or at least an excuse, however you want to look at it, under the policy to no longer accept registrations from that law firm. And I don't think that's what we want. I don't think that's the intention of the folks on the call. So I think that we should take a closer look at the potential side effect of that. If there's a way to do that just by shoring up the language and capturing what we want to say, then I think we should do that quickly on the list. Thanks.
Thanks, James. I think the operative word there is quickly. I think we need to do that today. So let's do that today. I think as you asked, you get Mary to put that language out, and you can formulate a response, and we'll have that discussion and hopefully wrap that up in the next few hours so that we can allow staff some time to include all the work that we've done today and get a new version out so that everybody has the most amount of time as possible to review. I'm seeing people who have to drop off for other calls. We've got about 3 minutes. Does anyone else have any other issues before we leave here to go wrap up those last final tidbits?
I have a question. It's Chris. So was my point earlier carried?
Sorry. Pardon me?
Was my point earlier carried?
Yes, it was.
Cool. Okay, that was easy. Thank you.
Thank you. And sorry, I realized I forgot about you earlier. So Mary's saying they'll do their best to get everything as requested ASAP today. Stephanie's asked about Holly's point. Holly's edits were that she put to the list were approved, assuming that's what you're talking about.
Yep.
Great. So let's leave it there. Thank you, everyone, for coming. That was a long call. We got through a lot of pieces. There's light at the end of the tunnel. Let's see how quickly we can crank through those last two pieces, and let's try and do that today. And then we'll begin our consensus process. So thank you, everybody. Have a good afternoon, and we can do this. We can finish it up quick. Thanks.
Thanks, Graham. Thank you all.
Thanks.
Bye.